Hi, this is Eddie Kramer, and you're listening to Nate on the Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by VMGVinyl.com. Professional record cleaning, restoration, rejuvenation, and grading.
Refresh your records with VMGVinyl.com.
And with that, on with the show. Well, hey, everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 429 of the Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And ladies and gentlemen, here we are. December 2023, with what is likely the last episode of the Vinyl Guide of the year. And I do want to take a few moments to thank everyone, all you listeners, for all your ear time this year. I know you have many choices of what to spend time listening to, and I truly appreciate the fact that you choose this podcast to spend time with. That's a hugely gratifying thing to me, and the reason I stay at it week in, week out. And again, I'm very grateful to each and every one of you, the listeners, the Patreon supporters, our sponsors, and just everyone that's keeping the vinyl record and music industry going. It's not always easy times, but it's worthwhile, especially when we find those records we love. So again, much love to everyone out there that is listening, manufacturing, enjoying, and just part of the process of getting those records into the hands of people around the world. Thank you. Now today, I am very pleased to be sharing a conversation I had with a guest I've always wanted to have on the show for many years. He was on my list of day one guests I wanted to get on the show, and it finally happened. The legendary engineer, producer, witness, and participant of music history, Mr. Eddie Kramer. Now, Eddie, as you may know, has spent time with many of the greats in rock music, including Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin. And today we talk about many moments of his career with those folks and more. Eddie shares his thoughts on vinyl and analog in general. And we also talk about the latest Jimi Hendrix recordings recently discovered, the Jimi Hendrix Experience Live at the Hollywood Bowl from August 18th, 1967. I know that predates many of us. That album, Jimi Hendrix Experience Live at the Hollywood Bowl, is available right now on streaming services and, of course, vinyl as well. Grab a copy from your local record store and enjoy this amazing recording. Now, one final note, I'd just like to ask that if you're not currently following the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app of choice, please click that little setting, that follow setting, and you'll be able to get access to over 400 other episodes and interviews of the Vinyl Guide podcast anytime. Interviews with the likes of Matt Cameron of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, episode 425. Jody Stevens talking Big Star Records and more, episode 405. Jay Maskus of Dinosaur Jr., episode 393. Jason Bonham discussing his father and playing in Led Zeppelin, episode 383. Janie Hendrix, Jimmy's sister, episode 377. And so many more episodes. Please follow the Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. We don't put up a paywall. You got free access to all these episodes and more. Just simply follow, scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And with that, let's connect with Mr. Eddie Kramer, talk records, music history, and more. Ladies and gentlemen, this week on the Vinyl Guide, I'm very honored to have a legend of the record and audio industry with us today, Mr. Eddie Kramer. Eddie, how are you feeling today?
Very good, actually. Thank you. Considering the way the world is and what's happening, yes, I am fine. Thank you.
I've learned not to take things for granted as much anymore, so it sounds like that's not a unique experience. But speaking of experience, there's a new Jimi Hendrix recording, and I'm so stoked about this because what you and Janie and John are doing with Experience Hendrix and making these tapes and recordings available is phenomenal. Jimi Hendrix is one of these artists that I could just listen to all day. I've listened to that Songs of Groovy Children 8 record set multiple times, never get tired of it. He's just an artist that keep putting out those tapes and albums, and we'll keep listening to them. They're fantastic.
Thank you. I mean, that's an honor for me to hear you say that, and also an honor for me to be a part of what we do at Experience Hendrix. I mean, since 95, God, it's all that time ago. It's fantastic. What a journey. And it's something that I feel so excited about when I get in the studio, because I feel, you know, either it's the tapes that we're putting up and you touch the tape and you look at the box and go, good grief, 1967, what? You know, or, you know, we find a tape that has nobody's known about it and witness this new thing that we've been working on and restoring. And to me, this whole concept of restoration, it feels sometimes as if I'm part archaeologist, you know, with the little brushes, mm-hmm. brushing away the dirt from the stones and the bones, and then revealing something really spectacular. And it's I love it.
That's a great metaphor for it, because this recording, this Hollywood Bowl, August 18th, 1967, this is from a newly discovered recording. Tell me the story of this tape.
I don't know too many of the details. John was contacted by the owner of this tape, and John called me up and said, oh, we got this. I said, well, what's the condition? He said, well, it might be okay. We don't know yet. So we have, since we're on different coasts, I mean, I'm on the East Coast, of course, but our folks out in L.A., you know, at LAFX and Capitol and all the other studios that we'd be working in, you know, we would go to them first, because I think Janie and John were in L.A. and yeah. I'm doing this remotely. And so we put the tape up, and it actually is in pretty damn good shape. I don't believe it was baked, which is even more remarkable. And we transfer it using what I felt for many, many, many years now is the best A to D converter for rock, which is Burl Audio. And literally everything I've done that is Hendrix related has gone through that process, whether it's 16 track, you know, 8 track, 12 track, quarter inch, half, whatever. It's gone through the Burl, because I think it translates taking the analog information and converting it. And when you hear it back, it actually feels and sounds just like the analog. And that's what we do. That's the first process. And then after that, that's when the surgeon's knife comes out, which for me is still part of the pleasure of dissecting it and finding, okay, we are using a hybrid system, which is analog, the best of analog gear, which initially gives it the warmth. And then you go into the digital world and start figuring out how you can improve it beyond what the normal analog process could do. And, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, digital EQs and devices have become so clever and so refined that I'm able to, you know, juggle this balance between mm-hmm. the analog and digital worlds and combine them to make it really sing.
We've seen in recent weeks, really, the Beatles using, they call it AI. It's just, to me, it's equalization, right? I don't know if they're using AI because it's a buzzword, but you know, you're free to comment if you think that is truly AI. But well, is that something you would use?
It's an interesting question, because it's on everybody's lips and minds, and you hear it. God, it's in the news 24/7. I just saw this thing about the election in Argentina, and they're using AI to battle the two proposed leaders of Argentina. It's hilarious. I mean, in some ways it's hilarious. In other ways, it's actually very scary. So when one uses the phrase AI, it's not really, it's really very advanced digital manipulation. And now the technology has become so evolved that, you know, here's a cassette tape of John playing piano, and now they were able to isolate the voice. We've always had something similar, maybe not quite as good, but now as the technology has expanded, now we're really able to become quite clever about the quality that remains thereafter. And if it requires some kind of quote-unquote AI manipulation, okay, that's fine. But it's still a digital piece of information. And now we can, oh, wow, now we can put John's voice. Same thing with Hendrix. I mean, I'm sure if we found another tape that Jimmy's voice is buried, I know I could use something similar, which I've done before, but now it's going to be on a much higher level.
So with this technology and your knowledge of what's in the archive and the tapes, are there any projects you think, oh, wow, I'd love to be able to put this through that AI process to enhance the recording?
Yes, I preface it by saying I'm not sure if I would utilize the word AI. I would utilize probably more targeted to what I was looking at. It's basically digital information. So yes, the answer to that is yes. There are tapes that I would love to get my hands on with John and Janie and say, hey, maybe we can do X or Y.
Now, it seems like each year we're celebrating a new release, and the release quality has remained consistently high, which to me is a bit of a miracle. Just knowing these recordings are from the late 60s. Tape recorders weren't as common, obviously, then. The archive seems to have a tremendous amount of material. How close are we to the Jimi Hendrix archive running out of releasable material?
Never. I don't know. I just, who knows?
Well, you would, I would suspect.
Well, I mean, the ability, you know, you're probably aware of the fact that we've remixed Electric Ladyland. Mm-hmm. Dolby Atmos, and there was also the 1969, you know, live show at the LA Forum that we did in Dolby Atmos. This is a continuing process, and as we go digging back into the catalog, it's really important for me to be able to think to myself, if I go all the way back to some of the original four tracks, some of which are complete, you know, where you get, because the way we recorded was on one four-track machine, mix those four onto two tracks of the second four-track machine, fill that up, and then take the second machine, bounce those four back to the first machine. So it was a 4-to-4-to-4, or just a straight 4-to-4. And part of the complication would be to separate that stuff. Now, I've done a bunch of work on a lot of it, and I've managed to get up to about 8 tracks of really good sonic information. But now, let's see what happens. I'm very curious to see what the future holds without saying any more.
Okay. Well, hearing your tone and seeing your body language, that gives me hope that there's something really interesting around the corner on that. Now,
I would hesitate to use around the corner because that corner could be quite lengthy.
Well, all right. Well, fair enough.
Hopefully, yes.
Yeah.
Hopefully, yes.
Okay. So this tape. Again, it was just discovered somewhere. You're not sure of the story of the tape? It was in someone's drawer? Where, you know, where was this tape all those years?
I think John has the full story on that. It was some person who had contacted them, said, look, we've got this tape. We're not quite sure. And they had made a copy and sent it to John. And he said, this is great. He made the deal. Mm-hmm. And then I got to hear it. And I went, yes, we can make this thing sing. It's a fascinating tape because I don't know if you are aware of what the Hollywood Bowl looked like in 1967, but if you've seen a picture of the Hollywood Bowl, there's the stage, you know, you see that big curve, right, of the acoustic shell, as it were, and, you know, there's the hill that goes up at an angle, so it's a perfect amphitheater. And there's 17,000 bloody kids coming to see, I think it was the Monkees, if I'm not mistaken.
Mamas and the Papas.
No, excuse me. It began with an M and my brain crossed. I'll blame COVID for that anytime.
It's understandable. He just got thrown off the Monkees tour to Mamas and Papas, right?
Exactly. This is why it was twisted. So it's the Mamas and Papas, but same basic difference. Who, you know, is a pop band, et cetera, et cetera. But if imagine that one was sitting in the audience, and I've seen photographs on stage of this particular concert, there is a bloody great big pool right in front of the stage. I don't know if you knew that. I do think that, if I'm not mistaken, there was an announcement, get the kids out of the pool, and they can't. And there's a bunch of kids going in the pool trying to get up onto the stage, all just completely soaked. There was another incident like this in 1968, 2008 when we were recording in Florida for Miami Pump. And that was in this racetrack, horse for horses, you know, whatever.
Right.
There's these two tractor trailer flatbeds in front of the grandstand. Right. Yeah, no, it was the grandstand. Imagine this is in Miami, right? This mm-hmm. for Jimmy, this is 68. We're in the middle of Electric Ladyland. He had to fly down. I flew down to record this. I said, imagine these two flatbed tractor trailer trucks open there, and first group on one, next group on the other. And at some point during the show over the 2 days, I remember so distinctly that MC gets on the mic and says, "All right, you kids, there's this big pool right there in the middle of the stuff. You can't go in the pool. It's got sharks in it." Bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. So I always think of, I don't know why, but in my brain, I'm joining that incident with the Hollywood Bowl because there's a bloody pool in front of the stage. Life is strange, right?
Yeah, a shark-infested moat around the Hollywood Bowl stage.
Now that would be something. And you'd have to pay to get over the bridge, right?
No, you'd have to motorcycle. You'd have to jump a ramp.
Oh, right.
Yes, of course.
All right, yeah. Let's get back to business.
So now, Eddie, this show is about record collecting, music memorabilia collecting, a lot of nerdy music facts. Do you have a record collection, or have you transferred most of your stuff over to digital listening now?
It's kind of a mixed bag. We moved several times over the last few years, and most of it's in storage in the basement. I found myself not having much time to pull out the... I'm looking to my left, but I've got piles of CDs and piles of albums, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's Hendrix or Zappa or whoever else I've been... Well, all the artists I've been working with over the last God knows how many years, vinyl's king.
Mm-hmm. I mean, still in the Kramer house, vinyl is king. You got a setup.
Yeah, it doesn't get much better than vinyl. I challenge anybody on a good system, on a good day, in a living room where you put on, I don't care which band, whether it's Zeppelin, Hendrix, Stones, I don't care. And you sit there and you listen to a great pressing, you got to go, holy crap, this is real. And this tickles my inner neurons, my heart. You know, my heart sings when I hear that. It's great because it's analog.
Yeah. Okay, so that sentence has a lot of weight, especially coming from you, Eddie. You know, someone who's spent their life in studios working with some of the most renowned musicians, to be able to say... vinyl is the preferred preference of listening, or vinyl has an extra je ne sais quoi compared to the other formats, which are technically, I guess, on paper superior, but for some reason, vinyl seems to resonate more with humans. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, who are the scientists, you would say, with psychoacoustics and all of that, but there is something about the way analog sounds. Okay, we all know what it does. You know, the top end gets probably slightly rolled off, and there's mm-hmm. You know, when you're printing on tape, or if you're going through a great analog console and you're printing on tape, you're going to get distortion at various points in the equation. But it's the way the distortion is applied, and the totality of it is when it is mixed, whether you're mixing digitally. And by the way, I do this a lot. I mix digitally to have it, but I also mix to tape. And then I take the tape and put it back through the burl back into Pro Tools. So now I have a very good digital copy of what the analog is performing. When I get to mastering, I now have three mixes sounding slightly different. And then I'll pick one that I think, or the mastering engineer and I, whether it's Bernie Grumman or whoever I happen to be in the room with, and we listen and we go, analog for this one, or maybe the transfer. It's a subtle thing, but audio is a subtle thing. And then when you hear analog, where the band is so present and there's none of that annoying digital harshness. Now, some people don't care about that. And in fact, most kids today, unfortunately, are listening in earbuds. The amount of digital harshness and lack of quality makes me rip them out because I think it sounds like crap. Mm. It's unfortunate. And a lot of kids today just have no concept of what a good analog recording actually sounds like. And when you hear it, it just puts hair on the back of your head. It goes straight up, right? Anyway, so, I've talked enough.
No. We have you here to share that wisdom. But again, there just seems to be a difference in the reaction for humans of digital and analog or vinyl. And I've always just been very curious as to what that may be due to, because technically Atmos, all digital formats, they should have the same frequencies. They just, for some reason, don't seem to move us emotionally like vinyl seems to. So very curious if you have any theories on that.
Digital is impressive, no question. It can be very in-your-face, direct, heavy, cool. It's great. I mean, you know, I've been mixing the Hendrix stuff. It does sound very exciting in Dolby Atmos. And Jimmy would have certainly embraced the fact that I could take his guitar and really move it around the room and then up and down and stuff like that. Very exciting. It's great. Does it have the soul of the original two-track? And when I'm mixing in Dolby Atmos, I always constantly in sync with everything I'm doing, I have the original two-track stereo mix that I did and go back and forth. I'm not quite there yet. I need to be more like that. And it's very difficult because once you start breaking it apart and pulling it away, it changes your whole perspective. There's no question about it.
There's one record that you were involved in, Led Zeppelin II, that has a very interesting story around the hot mix on Atlantic. Are you familiar with this particular vinyl, right? Not obviously Led Zeppelin II, but this particular Robert Ludwig mix?
Excuse me, Mr. Ahmet Erdogan. I know you're no longer with us, but please don't beat me up again. You want the story?
Please do.
All right.
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey there, record collectors. There's a new service available that specializes in record cleaning, restoring, sticker removal, and professional grading.
VMGVinyl.com.
VMG Vinyl can help you make the most of your collectible records. From professional cleaning of records and sleeves,
removing old price tags and store stickers,
dry cleaning and rejuvenation of old shrink wrap to make it look like new, even providing you a professional play-tested third-party grade with either removable grading or encasing in plastic, you have a wide range of choices at VMGVinyl.com.
Buying a highly collectible record and you want it checked out by an expert?
VMG Vinyl can do that too. Head over there now and see what VMGVinyl.com can do for you and your collection. That's VMGVinyl.com, the one-stop shop for professional third-party grading, cleaning, and record restoration. That's VMGVinyl.com. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. There's one record that you were involved in, Led Zeppelin II, that has a very interesting story around the hot mix on Atlantic. Are you familiar with this particular vinyl, right? Not obviously Led Zeppelin II, but this particular Robert Ludwig mix?
Excuse me, Mr. Ahmet Erdogan, I know you're no longer with us, but please don't beat me up again. You want the story?
Please do.
All right. It is in the book, and it is going to be in the movie. All right, let's wind back, if we can, in time. And we'd finished mixing. By the way, Zeppelin II was mixed in 2 days over a weekend at a studio in New York City called A&R on 7th Avenue, which is where Phil Ramone, anybody who studies records, Phil Ramone, very famous producer and engineer, that was his home. And Jimmy Page and I were rushing to get the last bits of overdubs done, and we would come into a small little overdub room, not the mix room yet, prior to that weekend. We had a little amp, and we were finishing up guitar overdubs, which was just freaking amazing. I mean, he's just a genius, and we have always had a very good relationship. But anyway, time to mix. Now, it's 8-track. Mm-hmm. These tapes have gone from London to L.A. to wherever and ended up in New York, where I either overdubbed and also recorded a whole bunch of new stuff at Juggy Sound. So now we have a finished record. And we're mixing it in our studios, in their mix room, quote unquote. And I walk in and I see the console for the first time, and I'm going, okay, no slide faders. There's only 12 inputs, and they're all rotary. They're all rotary volume controls with steps in them. But it sounded good. I mean, the very primitive EQ and all the rest of that, and only 2 pan pots. So
you're telling me that center bit of Whole Lot of Love was done with only two pan pots?
Correct.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we get to Whole Lot of Love, and we're in the middle of mixing, and it gets to that section where you hear the first time, we're running it through, and I'm hearing woman, and then there's this other woman in there. Don't know what she's doing. when one looks at the, you know, here's your 8 tracks. Track 8, I think, was the final vocal, and track 7 was another vocal that he had done. Mm-hmm. Now, on the rotary volume control, or the pot as we call it, I had it turned down all the bloody way, and I couldn't get rid of it. It was breaking through. No matter what I tried, I couldn't get rid of it. So as this pot comes by, you hear woman, and then this other woman. Jimmy and I are looking at each other like this, because he's right next to me, and we both at exactly the same time reach for the pan pot, and I'm grabbing the reverb, and we're laughing our asses. Of course, it's like an instinctive thing. We both had the same idea at the same time. Mm-hmm. Well, and then there's reverb, and then there's panning, and that, and then the whole band kicks back in again. So the moral of the story is, leave the goddamn mistakes in. Now, let's go further. Now we've finished the record. There's this guy called Bob Ludwig, who had just opened up the first Sterling Sound mastering room at A&R Studios. And he apparently had a very good reputation, and I went to see him, brought him the tapes. And by the way, Jimmy called me up, somebody says, hey, Grammy, can you please cut it as loud as a fucking single? I want it so fucking loud. I want it as loud as a 45. Okay, Jimmy, see what I can do. And so we started experimenting on the cutting level. And fortunately, they were under 20 minutes size. So we knew we could push.
Had a little room to play with, yeah.
Well, if one looks at the grooves, and we were looking, we checked on the mic, microscope, and just looking at the grooves, and they're, oh, baby, there's a lot of kissing going on there. And I don't mean by lips. So that's the problem. So we played it back because we got it. I mean, that thing sounded stupid. It was almost as loud as a 45, as a single. And we played it back, checked it out. Yeah, there was a couple of little close kisses, but it tracked. It sounded fine. Fine, master off, send it off to mastering, goes to Atlantic Records. The next thing I hear is, this is maybe a month later, I'm down in Miami at Criteria Sound, and I get this message, Armin Oettinger wants to see you. Okay. I'm not sure where this is going. So I go, and he's in the back room, and he's looking at me like, I could tell this wasn't going to be good.
Kramer, who told you to cut that record so fucking hard?
I said, well, Jimmy Page. He would just went off, and he said, do you realize how many records we had to scrap? Blah, 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 the record. Apparently what had happened was an advanced copy was given to Jerry Wexler's daughter. Now, Jerry Wexler, of course, as you know, was part of the big
Atlantic team.
Upper drawer of Atlantic Records, creative side, you know, producer. And he was a great guy, you know, he's cut many records. Gave it to his daughter. She played it at school, and it skipped on the school record player. She, "Daddy, the record's skipped." Okay. They just stopped production. They pulled everything back and recut it. And I think they pressed 100,000 or whatever it was, which was a lot in those days. But they reduced the bass, they reduced the level, and it never quite sounded the same.
They took the teeth out of it. You're right.
Yeah. And I'm still looking for my copy of that. But well, there's a little thing we will talk about afterwards about that. So he's just ripping me a new one, Ahmed. And I say, "Well, I'm sorry." He says, "Well, you know, this is what happened." And that is the end of that bloody story. I got reamed because Pagey told me to cut it hot. And we still laugh about it.
Well, that record, that version, that Robert Ludwig hot mix is highly collectible these days. And I don't know if they recalled a lot of them or they just kind of let them go. I would imagine they wouldn't have recalled them. They would have just kind of, you know, remastered and then sold the next batch. But those copies are quite dear these days. Now, you said you haven't gotten a copy. Is that right? You're still waiting for yours?
Are they about $200 a piece?
Oh, you'd be laughing if you found one for $200. Yeah. If one that's in good nick, closer to a grand.
Wow.
Yeah. But they sound phenomenal. And you were in the room mastering that with Bob, yeah? Mm. Okay. Yeah. Because that version of Led Zeppelin 2, with all the other reissues that have come out, that's still the go-to
one. Nothing comes close. Well, because we, you know, I think we knew what we were doing. Or maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe we didn't know what we were doing, and maybe that's why it's so good.
Well, my question is then with the reissues, 8-10 years ago, weren't we able to kind of get close to duplicating that? What's the reason for that?
I have no idea. I wasn't involved, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. That's romantic and whatever.
Right.
I have no input on that.
Fair enough.
I don't want to get in trouble with somebody I know who I respect.
Fair enough. That's fine. We're not about gossip here, just about facts. So that's all good. But you and Bob worked quite a bit together. Not only, I mean, so many different records, including Band of Gypsies.
True. Which was actually mixed in New York at Juggy Sound.
Mm.
I mean, Jimmy and I were mixing that. That's a great story. So we're mixing, and Jimmy and I had put together what he felt and I felt by contribution, the best of the four shows. So we're in the middle of mixing. I remember Jimmy had his hat on. And it's in we reached a point, it's one of Buddy Miles' ridiculously long solos and improvisational voice. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And I'm looking at Jimmy out of the corner of my eye, and his head's going down. Brr, 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 and he gets down, and his head's on the desk, the hat's over his head. And he says, "I wish Buddy would shut the fuck up." That's a great story. Come on.
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, maybe with AI, you could reduce that now.
Oh, yeah.
What was it about you and Jimmy that worked so well together? I mean, he brought you over to the U.S., I believe, you know, to run the studio, as I understand. Why do you think he kept choosing you and went out of his way to make sure you were on the team?
That's very nice. Thank you. Actually, the person, just to be historically correct, the record plant was being built in New York by Gary Kellgren. And he had worked with Jimmy on occasion in New York. And then, you know, Jimmy was flying back and forth. And I was, this was the end of 67 going into 68. And I kept getting all these phone calls from Gary. Says, "Hey, man, the record plant's going to be cool, man. You got to come over. And I said, all right, okay, fine. I'm going to leave England and come to America to work. Because, you know, Jimmy's coming back to New York. He's going to work, all of that. And I thought, cool. Coming to America, great. New studio, this should be fun. And I remember I arrived in New York on April 17th, 1968. And, you know, Jimmy and I had already started cutting tracks at the end of 67 and the beginning of 68 at Olympic, all along the Watchtower, Spanish Castle, et cetera, et cetera. We'd cut that all on four track. And Chaz and Jimmy had flown over, I think, in March. And I arrived April 17th. They had only been in the studio a few weeks. And I walk into the record plant the next day because Gary had picked me up at the airport, and I was so blown away by America. I was just looking at New York skyline with the sun going up. I have pictures of all of that. Anyway, the next day I walk into the studio, and there's Gary sitting with Jimmy, and the first thing Jimmy says to me, "Where the hell you been, man?" It's like, he had no idea of the ties. It had just like evaporated. "Where have you been?" I've been trying to get my ass over here. But it was a wonderful change for me. It was really cool being in New York.
Yeah.
How could you not like New York? I fell in love with New York. It's like, hey, New York, I'm part of you now. What are you guys talking about?
Yeah. Oh, I love that city too. So, but you and Jimmy just were like simpatico. And so.
We were. And, you know, talking about that, I'm sorry, I digress, of course. But to go back to the very beginning, in January of 67, when I first met him, it was immediate, right from the first time I heard that first chord he hit, and right in front of me, hair stood up in the back of my head. My life changed in a nanosecond, and the rest is history. I just knew this was game-changing. And I scrambled to make sure immediately that he got the sounds that he was hearing in his head, and I was able to, I think, to get into his brain and show him that I could do things for him that were different. And so as we were literally recording, I had run the tape machine before I ran out into the studio, and I was recording everything as it happened. And every time he came up to the control room, I said, "Hey, check this out." He would look at me like, okay. And then he would run back into the studio and try something different with the pedals, with the amp, with the guitar, showing off. And was like, "Okay, you going to do that? All right, well, I'm going to see if I can top that." "Oh, yeah? Okay." "Oh, yeah." And then we kept trying to top each other, and then we just laughed because he just realized that I could get him anything he wanted and beyond. And that formed the basis of the relationship. And I mean, what was not to love about him? You know, he was the greatest guitar player I've ever heard, and probably will never hear anything like it in my lifetime, I don't think.
There's a couple tapes I wanted to, or a couple of events I wanted to ask you about, and to see if there are any recordings, even poor recordings that are unable to be circulated. There's a rumor jam with Jimmy and Frank Zappa. You know much about that?
It is a rumor. I don't know if it's real. Okay. That's a question for Mick McDermott.
Okay. All right. All right. I'll add it to my
I do remember hearing about it. I'm not sure if it's for real, because I've never actually seen that, or it's never come up in conversation. "Hey, we got to, you know, let's." Zappa loved Jimmy. And when I went to see Frank before he passed, up at his house in up in the hills, in the Hollywood Hills, lovely man. I got on with him like a house. I just loved that man. Just an absolute genius. And I don't know if you know, just last year, I mixed a live album that he cut in London at the Rainbow Theatre.
Is that the one where he was pushed off the stage?
This is the one he was pushed off the stage. And okay. You can actually, I've managed to figure out how to get that at the very end of the show. You hear that? And by the way, the show is phenomenal. The band is fantastic. You know, they had just come back from Switzerland after the fire where they lost all their gear.
Oh, the smoke on the water fire.
Smoke on the Water. They had all their gear in there. They said, well, we'll come back tomorrow, pick it up. And it was gone. The only thing they kept was a cowbell. That's the only thing. So you imagine they arrive in London, they got to do these recordings, and they're devastated, and they have to scramble to find gear and guitars and everything. So, but the show is magnificent. And it was recorded by none other than my old boss at Pi Studios in 1963. Well, that's where I met him in 63, Bob Auger. Mm-hmm. And here it's a 1971 show, and I'm looking at the box and it says recording engineer Bob Auger, and went, oh my God, this is the guy who taught me everything. And it was such an honor, such an incredible vibe. I mean, his recording is fantastic, of course, he's just a genius. Mm-hmm. And when I was in the house with Frank, he said, you know, I love Jimmy, and he showed me this burnt piece of guitar that he had that apparently was from Monterey. I don't know. I presume that is the one. But and then he said, you want to see my archives? I said, yeah, sure. And in the hill, built into the hillside, was this mammoth vault with every goddamn recording he'd ever done, film, video, tapes, everything. I mean, it was just and remarkably beautifully organized, like a proper library. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic guy. Anyway, yeah. We digress about Frank Zappa. But no, I don't know if that tape exists. A question for Mick Jones.
Yeah, okay. I've also asked the Vaultmeister if anything like that existed. He was unaware, but he said, yeah, ask the Vaultmeister. Huh?
Who
looks after the Zappa Vault?
Do you know, right.
Yeah, you know Joe the Vaultmeister?
Oh, yeah, Joe. Yeah. Joe and I, when we did this record, Joe contacted.
Yeah, he's the guy who, he's one of the only people who may know how to traverse that mountain of tapes that were left behind.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not sure if it's a reality.
Okay.
Something tells me it may not actually exist. But
there was another date where, again, another rumored date that Jimmy played in a New York club with Jim Morrison and possibly Janis Joplin.
That's possible.
That's possible. Okay.
Was it the nightclub that eventually became Electric Lady Studios?
I don't know the full that rumor.
Originally, it was called the Village Bar, and then became what's the bloody name? My mind just went completely bloody blank. I know the old name from the 30s, but I can't remember what it was. The Generation, of course, it was called the Generation Nightclub, which Jimmy used to go down and jam a lot in, and that became Electric Lady. But there, who knows? Somebody's got a cassette somewhere. Tell them to contact me and we'll fix it.
There seems to be so many tapes that kind of come up decades later. What are some of the more recent finds that have just astonished you that have lasted all these years, that newer entries to the Hendrix Vault that were incredible finds?
Well, certainly anything live, you pick them. I mean, there's got to be six or seven recordings of Jimmy live. Thank God. I mean, in the days when he was on the road, Abe Jacob, who was his front of house sound man, also was in charge of if there was a possibility of recording it. He'd rent an 8-track machine or hire a mobile company to record. Sometimes it was 4-track, sometimes it was 8. But those recordings are superb. We're lucky to have them. I mean, the Fillmore East is a classic example of all four shows. And, you know, when we've redone and remixed everything, and you can get this improvement in sound from what the first mixes were, which were good, but with modern technology, you really get full expanse. They're terrific.
Oh, yeah. You know, with Hendrix, I've got originals, original pressings. And the reissues that have been done recently by Experience Hendrix, those are my go-to records because they sound so damn good. But Fillmore East, that was a bespoke recording. Everyone was aware that was being recorded. That was planned. But there are things that come to the archive. They're like, oh, my God, some kid with a tape recorder taped this. And it sounds phenomenal.
This was the case, not quite the kid, but the case with Monterey, with
Hollywood Bowl.
Hollywood Bowl. So some guy had a tape machine and was running it off the console. And whoever was doing the front of house had it together, and the stereo out of the board fed into the machine. Hey, now.
So, Eddie, you've been part of so many mega projects and, you know, obviously some of the world's most beloved artists. I imagine there are some projects or albums or sessions you were invited to be part of that you couldn't at the time or for some reason couldn't make happen. What are some of those artists or albums that you had the opportunity to be part of but weren't able to?
That's a very interesting question. I guess I've been fortunate, you know, I've been able to pick some of the artists, you know, who have come to me out of recommendation, or it's a continuation with Kiss, for example. You know, I did their demo, which then got them their record deal, and then I didn't work with them for the first two albums. And then I get the call from Neil Bogart at Casablanca one day and says, "Hey, Eddie, you know, the guys want you to do a live. Are you up for that?" And I said, "Neil, this sounds really cool. Can I call you back in about 5 minutes? Click. And on my desk was a tape from a guy in Boston who happened to have a band called Boston, Tom Schultz. And I'd listened to it, and I picked up the phone, and I called him. I said, "Tom, you know what? I'd love to work with you on this. However, you should put it out just the way it is. It's so bloody good, but I don't know what I could do to better it." And I truly meant that. It was genius. I mean, it was beautifully done. And I didn't. And so I picked up the phone and called Neil and said, "All right, I got to do it. I love a challenge."
So Boston came to you, but it was fully formed. And you took the Kiss. I guess this is Alive, right? This is the phone call for Alive. At the time, I mean, looking back, we know that that was a huge changing point for Kiss. Was the pressure on there? Did you know at the time, did the band know at the time that that album was going to be make or break?
So it's a great story because, I mean, I know there's a lot of Kiss fans out there. I don't know if you are. I see. I thought you were going to bring me a Kiss album. No. They're on their final tour. Final. I hope it is for these guys.
I'll show you something, Eddie. This is our family's Christmas card this year.
Oh my God, you're joking, of course. That's hilarious. Oh, you got to send me a copy of that, would you?
I will.
Yeah, that's very funny. I love it. So, you know, I say to the guys, "Look, we're going to record live. Don't worry about me. As long as it's from my perspective, the show's more important. We get what we get." But it was a real trick trying to be able to get the guys without destroying what they're doing from a show perspective. And they did. They just jumped. They're jumping around with their high boots. You know, stuff is going out. Bombs are coming. It was when one listened to the tapes, finally got the 16 track back to Electric Lady. And I put them up and I'm listening. I go, "Man, there's so much out of tune stuff here. We got to fix a bunch." So we spent quite a few days fixing guitar parts, punching in stuff, certainly vocals. Drums were good. And it was a bit of work to make it feel and sound correct. And we had these loops. I made up these loops of tape. They were about 100 foot long. I had about 5 tape machines out in the studio, the tape running from there back into the control room and back out again. It was like, you know how when you're dubbing a movie, you have these loops of audience and stuff. That's exactly, yay! And all that on different faders, I was able to recreate some of the stuff that was maybe missed, you know? And it took a while to mix it, but man, the results were fantastic. I mean, we even went back in and remixed one of the sides because it didn't sound quite the way we wanted it to. But they were great to work with, and that broke them. And we thought, oh, yeah, we'll sell a couple of 100,000 like the other records. They're 200,000-300,000. We thought that would be great. All of a sudden, this thing took off like a bloody rocket. It was at 500,000, went gold. We went, what? And it was at a million. What? And it just kept going. And it just made Kiss. It did something else. It combined with the sales of that record and the sales of a very famous R&B pop singer. You think you know who I'm talking about. At the same time, had a big, big hit, Donna Summer,
mm-hmm.
at Casablanca Records, was saved.
Yep.
Why? Because the idiots prior to that had pressed a million copies of who was the band who used to play for Johnny Carson?
The trumpet guy.
Him.
Yeah. Doc Severinsen.
It's like, why would you press almost a million copies of this big band? So they lost their shirts on that, and this saved their ass, these two records.
Well, yeah, and it also, as a result with Casablanca Records, it probably saved the economy of Colombia during the 70s. So that was... we were talking earlier about Australia, and there's this little-known band out of Australia, I think that you may have had some conversations with in the early days. Tell me about your involvement or engagement with AC/DC.
Right. It was like this, like, you know what I mean? I was asked by the A&R department to come and check out a band they were considering signing.
Right.
And they had a video, and I went down to the Atlantic offices and looked at this video of this band from Australia called AC/DC. And I was checking this band out, and I couldn't believe it. Man, the energy level and the guitar tone and the mm-hmm. ability for the two guitar players, who were the brothers, was so tight. And they had this stripped down, in-your-face, cool rock feel. It was like bits of R&B, rock, pop, but with an attitude and a swagger that I thought was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the late 70s, 78, 79, somewhere in there. And I flew down to Australia. I met the band, and I'm not sure that I was really welcomed, because Atlantic, in their wisdom, has decided that Kramer's the guy, you know, he's done Kiss and blah, 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 blah. You guys should work with this guy. And they did not like that recommendation, because they're individuals, you know, they're very strong-minded. And I got that. But we cut some demos at the Alberts Brothers studio.
Yep.
And it was unbelievable. Boy, were they tight. I can't believe I still have cassettes of that rough mix of those songs. God, they were just so tight and so funky, and just the groove of the band, and the way, you know, there's this very distinct movement between drums, bass, guitar, and it just moves along from side to side, and you just can't stop. It's just insistent. I loved them. And we came to an agreement, okay, let's try something. We'll bring you over to Australia, from Australia to Miami, and we'd stop rehearsals. We'd started rehearsals, and boy, became very apparent I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think my perception of what they wanted and their perception of what I wanted was different. And mm-hmm. I realized I was completely wrong. When you get to a point in your life and you realize, and you look back and say, oh, Christ, that was stupid. Why did we do that? Well, who put that together? And the attitude, you know, you can't go in and have a different attitude. My head was not in the right space. I know mm-hmm. that for sure. And fortunately, they got to work with a fantastic record producer, Mutt Lang, after another South African guy. And God bless them, they made those wonderful records.
Yeah.
A life lesson learned.
Was this prior to, I guess, the Highway to Hell album, or Powered, okay. Because, yeah, around that time, yeah, they were starting to look to branch out. But the producers you were probably working with down here were George Young and Harry Vanda, the ones from Albert Productions who got them to that point. And George is...
Yeah. You're right. I got the Albert thing stuck in my brain, but you're right. It was Young
Band. Because George Young is actually another brother of Angus and Malcolm. And so they kept it all in the family. It was very protective.
Very tight. I mean, they were so tight. I mean, that's why, you know, they put up this wall. And understandably so. Who's this fucking guy coming in, you know, to try to tell us? And you learn your lesson. You say, well, that was nice. I'm glad I got to meet them, but I'm glad you guys made it.
Huge. But you still have tapes of those early recordings, those early demos that were done in Miami, did you say? Or
done in Australia.
One last thing before we wrap up, Eddie, is the beginning, going back to Led Zeppelin, Black Country Woman. At the very beginning, you could hear the airplane. And I believe you were having a quick chat with Robert at the time. What do you recall about that moment?
So it's another one of those classic moments of leave it all in, mate. So on this particular day, we were at Mick Jagger's mansion called Stargroves, and we were cutting a whole bunch of tracks. And on this particular day, it was a lovely day. It was a summer's I guess an early summer's day. The grass was green, the little yellow dandelions were coming up, and the lad said, let's record outside, shall we? And I thought, well, that's a good idea, isn't it? And because, you know, we've been in the mansion and we've got these huge drum sounds. Of course, we would still have Bonzo's drums in there to cut the basic track. Mm-hmm. They wanted to record the acoustic guitars outside on the lawn, Jimmy and John Paul Jones. Mm-hmm. Cool, right. There's no acoustic. I mean, it's just a dry sound of the acoustic guitar outside. Wonderful. So there we actually finished drums and two acoustic guitars. And Robert was coming in to do a vocal. He said, well, I'm going to sing outside too. So we stick up 67. And I've got this lovely picture of him on the lawn. There's the truck, mm-hmm. you know, painted military colors, you know, all the camouflage. And there's the house behind him. There he's standing in front of the mic. And I'm in the truck. And I hit record, and I said, as it's recording, there's this freaking huge four-engine, you know, not a jet, a four-engine prop plane, like a World War II bomber coming overhead because we were near an Air Force base. And it's like, boom. And I clicked the tube. I said, oi, what about this airplane then? And Robert says, nah, leave it. And that's on the tape, and it's in the mix. Why not leave the damn mistakes in? It's that same thing with Whole Lot of Love. Leave them in. It gives it character, and people remember that shit.
Yeah.
Which we have a tendency today to edit out. The amount of fine-tuning and editing in Pro Tools sessions drives me up the bloody wall.
Yeah.
It's stupid. If there's a little bit of hair on it, you got to leave it in.
Well, one of my favorite Led Zeppelin moments is that clam note that Jimmy Page hits at the end of Rock and Roll. I just love that. And yeah, if that was recorded these days, someone would have probably said, let's chop that out. Like, no, that gives a character.
That's it.
Yeah.
I live for that. I live for those moments when the shit just goes wrong, but yet it sounds so right.
That's what makes it interesting. All right. Well, Eddie, thank you so much for spending time here with us and telling those stories in the Vinyl Guide. And again, I want to thank you for all the work you've done, especially with the Experience Hendrix tapes. Every year, at least, we get some new gems. And again, this new Hollywood Bowl album is well worth the listen. It's on all streaming services. People can dial it up right now and enjoy it. It's Jimi Hendrix Experience, Hollywood Bowl, August 18th, 1967. It's also available on vinyl. Grab yourself a physical copy and feel the sound waves in the chest. JimiHendrix.com. Again, Eddie, an absolute honor to have you on the show, and thank you very much for your time, mate.
My pleasure. And when you're listening to that Hendrix performance at the Hollywood Bowl, just remember, don't put your feet in the pool.
Will do, mate. Eddie, thank you again for your time, mate. Much appreciated.
All right, mate. I got a bugger off.
All right. Cheers. Cheers. Oh, man, there we are. The legend himself, Mr. Eddie Kramer. Very grateful to have spent some time with him, and I'm very happy to be sharing it with each and every one of you. As I mentioned, this is probably the last podcast episode of the year. I may get some sort of wild hair or something happens where I put something out there, but probably not. I need a rest. And you know what? I think each of you probably want to be spending some extra time with your families and friends and your record collection. So I want to wish all of you a very happy and safe holiday. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, whatever you celebrate. I hope it's great. Be well, be safe, keep spinning them records. And again, thank you so much for being part of the Vinyl Guide universe. Well, that's it for this episode of the Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Big shout out. Thank you to everyone who shares these episodes on social media. That is hugely helpful. Getting the word out. I do appreciate it. And all of you who've left positive reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, that's a huge help as well. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.